tonight, huh? Old drummer. Come on, you.
Well, good evening, and thank you for joining us on this fine, it's a February evening for me. It'll be a March evening for you, or morning, I guess, when you go to listen to this.
Hello from the past.
Hello, from the past future thing. This is the Drunken UX Podcast. I am your host, Michael Feenan.
I'm your co-host, Aaron, or other host? You need to come up with a name, just because I go second.
Flight attendant. That's the only way I know to go with that. my glass is getting a little bit empty, sir. Would you tend to that?
I'm your flight attendant, Aaron Hill, and welcome to the Drunken UX Podcast.
This week we are talking about CSS in JS, which is something we briefly mentioned. And when I say briefly, I mean I think it got a line back around episode 14, I think Aaron corrected me on earlier.
13. I just looked 13. It up.
Mm-hmm. We were talking about CSS methodologies, things like CSS BEM, ways to organize your style sheets in a way that would make sense for your markup. And so this is specific to the JavaScript environment. So we've got a guest on with us that we will be bringing in just a moment. First off, I want to make sure to let everybody know that this episode of the Drunken UX Podcast is brought to you by our friends over at NewCloud. You can check them out at newcloud.com/DrunkenUX. They do interactive maps and have their whole content management system underneath that. It's very cool. It's hosted on Amazon CloudFront and does super sweet things. And then go find us other places.
You can check us out on Twitter and Facebook.com/DrunkenUX and on Instagram at the Drunken UX Podcast. You can also get us on DrunkenUX.com/Slack. Come and chat with us. And actually, I think if you don't already follow us, you should follow us, and you should retweet this episode.
There will be a reason why.
Yeah, we'll get to that later.
We'll get to it. I do know that if you follow us on Instagram, I just got them really excited because they're very show appropriate, quite frankly. I got coasters.
They're so awesome.
So if you are headed up to Missouri by chance for the Web Accessibility Summit at the end of May, I will have some of those with me. They are just fun little, you know, drink coasters with Drunken UX on them, and they're pretty slick. I like them. I'm sending a bunch to Aaron, so if you're up in his area or going to any Ruby events where he's at, hit him up. He'll have a few there too. Fun little things. This evening, I am imbibing upon another bottle of Monkey Shoulder. I've had this before, I'm pretty sure. It's a blended scotch. Fantastic. Love the name. Love the bottle. Very good. The only blended scotch, actually, that I genuinely like always keep in my bar. So
when you tweeted about that, I thought you were referring to like a Charlie horse, like your leg hurts, but like on your shoulder.
But that's what the name comes from, you know.
Monkey
shoulder is a thing that the people who are in the brew house, whatever it's called, where they age the scotch,
yeah,
when they are moving barrels. And they grab these big, heavy barrels full of scotch and roll them. The repetitive stress injury that they would get was a shoulder injury, probably rotator cuff, something or other, that they called monkey shoulder.
Wow.
So that is actually, the name does actually mean something.
Nice. I've just got, I went classic today. I've just got a Svedka and tonic. That's in Rose's lime juice. It's tasty. It's cold like the outside.
Yeah, nothing like a refreshing drink on a cold February night. That's exactly what you need. What I used to really enjoy, I haven't had it on the show, but maybe next episode, I used to do hot chocolate with a Mocha Kahlua. That is a treat for a cold night.
Yeah, I could see that.
So this evening, we have a very special person joining us, Dustin Shao. Shao?
I hope. That's correct. Shao.
I checked a couple places, and that was the way I heard it, so I just ran with it.
I guess we could have checked in the pre-show, right?
Could have, but what's the fun in that? Dustin is the author of CSS in JavaScript with Styled Components and React over at Manning Publications. He is also a software engineer at Gatsby.js. If you're not familiar with Gatsby, it is a what I'm going to call a static site generator, although that does not really do it justice. If you're familiar with other tools like Jekyll or Next, if you've used either of them by chance, Gatsby is in that same sort of company, but obviously bigger, I think.
Although you were saying it does more things.
Yeah, so let me take a sec. So I would not say it's necessarily bigger than any of them. Next is the most analogous to Gatsby because they're both in like the React space. Jekyll's in, I think, the Ruby, like built with Ruby, I believe. So Gatsby is a static site generator, but I like to think it does so much more. So we've been calling it kind of like an app compiler. Basically, it's a compiler for your applications. It'll optimize your images, your JavaScript, your CSS, you know, everything that you don't really want to like fiddle around with. We'll do that all for you and like serve up like a super performant, fast application. Cool. So if you haven't checked out Gatsby yet, definitely check it out. It's pretty cool stuff.
It scares me because at the end of the day, I know that basically we've brought somebody on the show who is like light years smarter than either Aaron and I. So this is going to be great fun because the reality is, Aaron, of course, is a Ruby developer. I am a front-end developer, but not in the JavaScript space. So this is going to be a really interesting sort of chance to kind of learn some of this. And I mentioned that Dustin wrote, recorded is probably a better way to put it, the CSS and JavaScript course. Fantastic course. Aaron and I both went through it before jumping on the show, just so we would have a way to converse about this intelligently. And it is incredibly good. And we'll have some information about it at the end of the show. First off, I want to stop for just a second. This last week, so we're recording this last week of February, not last week, next to last week in February. Google has just put out on, not just put out, it has been a while coming, but they bought the .dev TLD from ICANN. Now they are making those the domains available on that TLD for purchase. And I just wanted to check because I'm sure, Aaron, right, you went out and bought aaron.dev. I have no doubt, right?
Obviously. With the $12,000 that I had sitting around.
I mean, it's money well spent at the end of the day, right? So what they did, so Google went out, they bought this TLD and they set it up for developers, obviously. And they built some stuff in. One of the cool things about it is it's already got HSTS built into the preload on the DNS entries. So any .dev domain name you use has to have SSL on it, period. That's cool. And of course, we all know with what Google has done with Chrome in terms of warning people about secure sites and the way somehow it kind of factors into PageRank, whether or not you've got SSL enabled or not. This idea of them forcing it on .dev TLDs makes sense for them, I think. Mm-hmm. I kind of have viewed this as an alternative to the .io domain name.
I saw that there was like github.dev already, and I'm not sure I understand. So we have github.com, and I love GitHub, but github.com, github.io, and github.dev now?
And what's on github.dev? Is it just an alias for them?
Maybe, yeah. Do you remember when it was just like, I mean, it's on old and crotchety here, but like when the TLDs, it was like, you know, .com, .net, .org. .gov and .edu, and then some the country codes and maybe a smattering of some others. But it was sort of like the purposes of the TLDs were sort of like .com was for commercial, .net was for service providers, .edu was higher ed, and .gov was government, and .org was supposedly like maybe nonprofit, maybe not. But like they sort of had roles for all the TLDs. I have no idea what all the new TLDs, like what the roles are for them.
I can tell you what .xxx is for.
For really, really big websites.
Triple extra large websites.
Extra, extra, extra large. Yeah. It's for the Vin Diesel. It's the Vin Diesel top domain.
I just pulled up github.dev, your website closer to your code. So they've got a personal website generator.
Oh, okay.
That they're promoting through it.
Wasn't that what github.io did, though?
Well, I don't know. Anymore. That's why I say I look at it kind of as an alternative to that, because I see it as a TLD meant to provide resources to or for developers, basically.
Yeah.
I've talked to some other folks who will use it as a development site. So they will build things on that so they can show it to other people. You know, if they're working with a client or whatever, they'll put the site under that .dev domain temporarily. I mean, it's definitely a neat idea, and I have every intention. I will buy Phenon.dev. Please don't. Yeah. Well, it won't matter. By the time you hear this episode, I will have bought it, so it's okay. The nutty part is, though, nutty, brilliant in a way. What Google did was they have started pre-selling these domains. So for the week that we're like recording this episode.
Pre-boarding an aircraft?
Kind of, yeah. So you know when you get in.
I am the flight attendant tonight. So.
Oh yeah, yeah. You know this. Yeah. You obviously are well versed in the group boarding process. You pay your extra $40 and you get your domain early. But like you said, it's not $40. The initial round was $12,000, give or take $500. And they slowly step it down every day of the week down to $125. Okay. At which point everything opens up and it's your normal $12 a month, or $12 a year registration fee. The idea being that if you really absolutely must have your domain, it at the onset,
squatting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't think it's a terrible idea, quite certainly. And it also gives them a way, if for those who don't know, if you want a custom TLD from ICANN, it costs $185,000 to get that.
Yeah.
Plus, they have to vet you and consider you real. Like, if you were just a dude with $185,000, they're not going to give you a TLD.
Do you remember the .sucks TLD?
Yeah.
Yeah, kind of like that, but less mean.
I get what Google's doing there. I think it's cool. There's one of the best sites I've seen on it that they launched with early on was accessibility.dev.
Ooh.
They've got a color contrast checker and a page checker there. And, you know, there's documentation on how to build accessible websites. I think that's very cool. Because I think it very clearly articulates that this is a development resource, and I like that thinking. Nice. I do wonder, and Dustin, to throw the ball in your court a little bit, you know, how that's going to factor into a lot of open source projects. And like, is there going to be a Gatsby.dev, and what would be on it? Versus
actually a great question. We were talking about it yesterday internally. no one better buy it from under us, because we're gonna wait it out a couple more days at least. But we were thinking maybe for like error messages. So we have like a Gatsby.app domain we use to like link to like documentation. And so we were gonna maybe see if we can look into Gatsby.dev and then /, like some error message that we can show in our code. And then you can pull that up and it'll redirect to, our documentation.
That's cool. A neat idea. Yeah.
Yeah.
Then you know, like, if you're getting referred from something internal to the application, it's like, here's something that, you know, this error message isn't going to be useful to the normal user. But if you're building the site, it's like, I kind of like when I admit I use Windows in my day-to-day life, because most of us do. And, you know, you get the blue screen and they give you the error code and you have to go search for it. They throw the QR code up there, but we all know that's not very useful. But having that resource that's like, we're going to give you detailed information on why this happened. Here's where to go get it. That's a cool idea. I like that.
Yeah. I also saw there's a recent new Node.js.dev site as well. So we're talking about, a few of these. That one's kind of cool. It's built with Gatsby. So if you haven't checked it out, go check it out. It's a Gatsby app, another .dev domain.
Well, yeah, we'll throw some links up to some of that too. It's interesting to me too, because from the standpoint of who's going to get in where is, of course, valuable in some of that space. How people plan to use it will be very interesting. And what individuals are going to do with it, I think, will be kind of just neat to watch unfold and see, because it is a high-value domain. There was a lot of hand-wringing that went on early on, because a lot of people use .dev in local environments as
developed.
That's right. And when it showed up in Chrome, some smart folks found it in some of the Chrome code that they were reserving this .dev TLD before they had announced anything. Mm-hmm. It was like, what are we supposed to do? Our answer was, we just started using .local. It was easy.
Work for now. Hey, so before we get to the meat of the topic, the talking about boarding a plane in groups, I saw an awesome visualization by CGP Gray about different plane boarding algorithms. It's 16 minutes long or 20 minutes long or something like that. And it just shows people boarding a plane with different
Yeah.
Like pattern.
Do it like the outside to inside.
Yes. Well, no, not outside to inside, but the most, I can't remember the name of it. It was like the shift modified or something like that. But it was like all window goes in and then all middle seat and then all aisle seat.
Yeah. Outside to inside.
Yeah. Yeah. but rather than like back to, oh, okay, is that what you meant? Okay. Outside then, yes. Yeah. Yeah. I thought you meant like both sides of the plane inwards.
Oh, no. Yeah. That's mechanical.
But yeah, it's really cool. Let's see if I can do like an RTO or something for this. This is really neat.
So the meat and potatoes of this evening is all about CSS in JS. And I think I want to start because obviously we need to define what that means, because for a lot of folks, CSS in JS, you know, the closest they maybe have gotten is using like jQuery dot, you know, CSS and passing in their stuff. There's a quote from a Hacker Moon article we'll throw in that's got a ton of information about this. The way they defined it was they said, no longer do you have to maintain a bunch of style sheets. CSS in JS abstracts the CSS model to the component level rather than the document level. And I thought that was a relatively good definition of what we're going to be talking about this evening. And this idea of how do we take these giant style sheets that we write, and whether you've done them in SAS or something of that nature, and spread them out, whether you've got lots of handwritten CSS, because we all do it from time to time. This is a way of abstracting that concept. And so that's what we're looking at. let's dive in. So why? Let's talk about why. And this comes down to the scope problem. I think is I'm going to say the scope problem, and I think that's a fair assessment. And I'll let Dustin correct me on that if there's maybe more to it than that. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, so I'd say scoping is probably one of the most easily, like, quantifiable and like understandable benefits. So people who've, you know, written CSS more than just like on like a small, like trivial app have probably ran into a case where like you apply a message class to something and then, or like a button class to something. And, you know, you apply color blue and then your button is red. And you're like, well, like, why the heck is this button red? Like, I applied this rule, color blue, it should be red. And so the scoping problem is basically, in CSS, that every class, every selector is kind of like global. And so it's really easy to run into conflicts by basically conflicting with some existing rule that someone else wrote that you might have written and forgot about it. So yeah, that's one of the easiest benefits to kind of talk about with CSS and JS, because it kind of gets rid of this whole issue.
Yeah, and it comes back right to what we talked about in that episode 13, where the whole idea comes down to this idea of the struggle we have as an industry with the C in CSS.
Mm-hmm.
Style sheets are meant to cascade. That's how they were designed. And this idea that if you, you know, do a star selector and say, you know, font size 18, then you expect everything on the page to be font size 18. And that was, at its time, you know, that was a revolutionary concept, this idea that we could just make everything on the page look a certain way.
I think that a lot of, I mean, knowing why the star selector wouldn't do that, or knowing why if you make a button class that makes it the button blue or whatever, but it doesn't work correctly, like knowing why beforehand or knowing how to fix it is something that comes with experience. I rarely ever have scoping issues with the CSS that I write. I do a lot of stuff in SAS, so like you can innately put your styles underneath, like, you know, basically create nested blocks. And then if you make a message class or an alert class or something, but it's underneath the parent block, you'll never run into a scoping problem except within that block.
Yeah.
Do you use like BEM or like an approach like that usually, or something kind of like it?
I don't. I've looked at BEM. I'd say that my approach is probably the closest to BEM overall, but like
not strictly.
I go for very semantic looking class names, and I try to use the HTML tags themselves as much as possible. only overriding them with classes when it makes semantic sense. I've looked at tachyons after the article, the episode 13 about that. And I had already seen BEMS. I've looked at atomic CSS also. I don't know. Like I know the version that I know and it works for me, so I haven't had much incentive to change.
Atomic CSS is a whole other world of pain. Let me just throw that out here. It's neat. It's a very cool implementation, but it is not as easy as people would have you think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess my main thing is like, I don't ever want to tell someone that like what you're doing is not, you know, good. Cause like if you have solutions to this problem, like all the more power to you. That's awesome. Mm-hmm. But generally I like CSS and JS because it's kind of like automating these like things that I could do manually. And you know, for instance, like if you're diligent, if you're following BAM, if you're following like this nesting structure, like that might work great. But you know, our industry is all about like using automation to solve problems that you don't want to solve or don't really want to think about. And so like, why not use automation? Why not use, you know, some of these tools we'll talk about to like solve this scoping problem. And so to me, it makes a lot of sense to use CSS and JS.
One thing you do in your course that I think is really cool is you talk about the use of like props and like the attributes, right? Props?
Yeah. Okay. Props. Yep.
Yeah. So there's a way to like have the props kind of like automatically update the behavior of the CSS class. That's cool. Like that was something that I didn't know that you could do before I saw your course, and I thought that was really neat. It's still like, I still feel like some of it is weird.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a violation of separation of concerns, like, but we can get to that later.
It's very much, and so to talk a little bit about, you know, the skills that come into this, as we talk about CSS and JS, one of the important things to keep in mind is this is a very, I'm not going to say entirely because that's not the right way to put it, because obviously these tools can be cross-applied in some cases, but it is a very React-centric methodology. And while we may look at, when we talk about a pattern like CSS BIM, which for those that aren't familiar, CSS BIM is a style of naming your classes where you go block element modifier. And it's this idea of trying to apply a convention. CSS is extremely well understood across the board, as far as I'm concerned. And now that we know it so well, now we're trying to figure out how to do it really efficiently.
Leave it up to programmers to take something that has been solved and then make it unsolved again.
And the scope problem, I think, is very real, because even if an individual is very well versed in how their stuff may apply to other elements and how they can write classes to have it not affect other things, it's still a problem that people learning it go through, and this challenge that they realize, mm-hmm. Oh crap, I've written this one rule, and you know, because of the way the selectors are inheriting the stuff from, you know, whether it's star, mm-hmm. body, P, any of these things, this problem becomes very challenging for them to understand. And it's part of the arc that every developer is going to go through.
Yeah.
From day one, when they pick up CSS and realize that they can have power over it, they're going to learn that scoping is a challenge. And then down mm-hmm. the road, they will realize they can address that. And there are a million ways with which to do that. And that's what BEM does. And that's what I think we're looking at here in React specifically. Like, this pattern is very much anchored in that, and if you're going into that JavaScript realm, so to speak, I really like this as an approach versus, say, inline styles, because inline styles are a very popular way. Again, when you start, it's the first thing you learn, so you kind of figure out, oh, I can do all this. This is the evolution.
I would say if you've already decided I'm going to do React for this project, like, this is definitely the approach you want to do. Dustin, your course is specifically based around React, right? I don't think I missed any sections.
It is like the first couple modules, you know, just like collections of videos are like React focused, because we use a library that is a React library. But the last couple sections, and kind of like interwoven throughout, are CSS and JS like approaches, or CSS and JS approaches that don't require React. So one of my favorites is CSS modules. Hopefully we'll get a little more into that. But while it's kind of exploding in the React space, this whole idea of CSS and JS, other, you know, libraries like Angular, like Vue, et cetera, they all have like a very CSS and JS like approach for authoring your styles. So I think we're going to keep seeing it kind of like be a definitive like go-to for a lot of these newer libraries and frameworks.
It's a methodology, right? That how you execute on that methodology has options.
Mm-hmm. The library you use in the first part of your course brain is a styled component.
It's called styled components. So I like to think of like CSS and JS as kind of like a spectrum. That initial definition we had kind of works. I think it really varies. Like to me, CSS and JS is just producing a style with JavaScript. So like that technically means, you know, if you're writing your styles in jQuery, like to me, that's kind of like the dictionary definition, that's CSS and JS. But that's like on like the left end, like inline styles are CSS and JS, but they're not really a way I'd recommend. And so some
not refined.
Yeah. It's like a more iterative, solves some similar problems that some of those other approaches might solve, but does it in, I think, like a much nicer, more developer friendly way.
And I like the styled components deal, and that's something I was again aware of, but I hadn't used at any capacity. And the one thing, if I have any complaint about any of this, it's the nomenclature. I've had a couple conversations when we started scheduling this interview. I went out and I started talking with some of my other developer friends about what their opinions were on CSS and JS and styled components and things like this. And I discovered that when I said phrases like styled components, they didn't know that that was an NPM package. Like that was, they just thought about it in terms of you're styling a component kind of thing. That's like the biggest complaint I think I'd have is that it's a thing, like it's an actual architectural element of your package. That's the toughest part. Let's though switch gears real fast, because the big part about this comes down to what the value is. Because like you said, you could write inline styles in your React app.
Mm-hmm.
You could sit down, and so when you create React components, you have a lot of power with regard to how you define your attributes, how you define what the actual component itself is called and how it renders. And so a lot of folks will say, we'll just write the styles inline. It changes quickly. It's something that, you know, again, React is named that way for a reason. It's designed to change very quickly in a single page app, an SPA, as the nomenclature goes. I like that word. I studied Latin in high school, so nomenclature has a warm spot in my heart. But this idea that this gives you a way to pull it out a little bit and write normal CSS that applies within, you know, your React components and things. So there are a lot of advantages. There are some drawbacks as well, I think, that are only fair to address in that context. So the first thing that comes to mind immediately is when you start talking about React in general and you're building these components, the reusable nature of them and the ability to say, I'm going to use the context of styled components because that's what you use, Dustin, in the course. If I write a component in that way, it makes everything nicely articulated. It's all in one bubble. And if I had to pick that up and use it somewhere else, it's all contained. Everything is right there. I don't need to bring in extra stuff or anything like of that nature. That reusability and portability of the code that this employs, to me, is where I see this becoming immediately valuable, as opposed to, okay, now I got to have a style sheet. The style sheet may have other stuff that isn't relevant to this, whatever the case may be.
It reminds me a little bit of, remember, 5-10 years ago when you would want to download like a jQuery widget of some kind, like Chosen or Autocomplete, one of those. You know, there'd always be like some just a smidgen of styles that would be like brought in beforehand. Then you would include the JS file, then you include the CSS file in your stuff. And
jQuery UI is comes immediately to mind. Like, okay, that's cool. You have jQuery UI, but you also have to include jQuery UI.css
and
all of that.
Yeah.
Because by itself, it wasn't enough. Whereas
right.
this feels like it makes all of that nicely compartmentalized.
It certainly puts it into one thing.
Yeah, for sure. So, yeah, I kind of started my career writing jQuery mobile. So I know that problem. And it's like, oh, now I got to, you know, grab the CSS and I got to grab the JavaScript. I got to import them in the right order and, like, you know, all of this stuff. So, yeah, I do think one of the benefits is that they're just really easy to, like, get up and running with. So if you're working on, like a component library, or you just if you want someone somewhere to use this component, it makes the setup really quite easy. You don't have to configure Webpack. I mean, besides already, you know, for the JavaScript stuff, you don't have to configure another loader for CSS. Yeah. Basically, you import this one component and the styles come along for the ride. So it's a really nice for reusability and just getting up and running really quickly.
It prevents leakage. That's the thing that we always deal with. And I think about, and we'll talk about this a little later as well, but this idea that you change a style thinking you're fixing one thing, but you break three others because you didn't realize how that cascades, the C in CSS, as it were.
I know that keeps getting brought up. I don't think that's as much of a problem as we're making it out to be, but maybe that's because I write bomb CSS.
I think the cascade can be like helpful. Like sometimes you want to like target this particular element, this particular like class, but generally that's not always what I want to do. And so like, you know, if we think of the importing the CSS approach, so let's say that you are really diligent about your own CSS, all right? But now you import this library or this package or this component library. Well, they have their own classes. They don't even know what those classes are. And so you know, you're importing both of these. Now you might have a conflict and you really can't know about it. So like one of the nice things about using style components or a CSS and JS, you know, library is that you can like with like pretty high degree of like certainty, like this is not going to impact anything else, particularly from a style perspective.
And I think I'm more worried because I work in a distributed environment. I'm in Kansas. I have another developer in Pennsylvania. I have another one in Boston. Two in Boston. That's the way that's how that translates. I have full and complete utter faith in the CSS I write because I also write bomb CSS. But it's when I have to work with a lot of other people also writing CSS that I feel like that's where we run into the problems. And that's where the worst examples of that leakage can happen. Mm-hmm. Or those cases where I change something thinking about the context that I've used it in and the thing I wrote it for, and somebody went, oh, well, you use that centered class, let's say, something very generic, and it should have only centered text, let's be honest. It shouldn't have done more than that if I'd written it in a really bomb way, to use the young people's lingo.
I think I'm older than you are.
You are. Congratulations.
Win!
But those environments are where I think that it really starts to show. Like I say, we are not a JavaScript dev shop. So we are writing just, you know, SAS and letting it go. And it's a constant fight back and forth sometimes of making sure to ask, hey, if I change this class, what's it going to impact? Because I know what I wrote. But when I've got two to three other devs that I have to have consideration for, there's a lot of crosstalk, and that happens, and that's a problem not just with CSS, but like if you're using Git repos and all of that, you know, that idea of checking your merge conflicts and making sure that, you know, you're not overriding old stuff or using different branches, there's a lot of cooperation that has to come into play to make that really work well.
I think so. A lot of that's a training issue, though. Like if I definitely have seen the things that you both mentioned. I typically see it with like junior developers when they're writing CSS. They don't have the experience to know when to make different considerations and choices about how they're structuring their CSS. And that's just, I mean, it's going to happen.
Yeah.
It's almost like, I kind of don't understand it sometimes, because I think a lot of people are like, well, I write good CSS. Like, my walled garden, my CSS, like it's almost like an argument for like laziness in some sense, but like I don't want to be diligent like that. Like I don't want to have to like, you know, enforce all of these like standards and practices, you know, whether it's BEM, whether it's nesting, whether it's like diligence. Like, of course I want people writing good code. I'm not advocating for, you know, write some like horrible code because, you know, you can be lazy, but I want to focus on like building things out. I don't want to focus on like fighting CSS even for 10 minutes. So for me, it's really appealing.
Two people can write the absolute best CSS for their circumstances. But when put together, there can always be unintended consequences. Anybody who's ever, if you've ever wondered how CSS works, there is an equation basically that comes into play that factors how CSS specificity is worked out. It's very straightforward if you're using one selector, but when you start nesting selectors, it gets very complicated. And the best written CSS on the planet, when combined with other CSS that is written the best way possible, can still cause conflicts that can't necessarily be foreseen unless you ask the right questions at the right time. That has been my experience.
I still think that's an edge case. I remain unconvinced that that is as big of a problem as perhaps we're really focusing in on it, but I don't think it's that big of a problem.
We
could just like disagree on that.
I think so. I do disagree, but yeah. But kind of like, I guess kind of like by way of an example, I think generally I think our team is really solid. Like we ran into this yesterday. So we had a CSS specificity issue. It's actually like fairly hard to debug. So we have our own CSS. We use a style components like library. We have a library that bundles CSS, our router, and they have the same specificity. So we have a class selector, we have an attribute selector. Those count for the same. Order matters. So not only does, you know, the like type of thing you're targeting, you know, IDs higher than class, you know, et cetera, which is not like an easy mental model to have. But like, we were including that CSS after our own CSS, so that one wins out. Not because it's more specific, just because it literally came after in our tags. And so like this, it is like an edge case in the sense that it doesn't happen like super often, but it happens often enough that like I do think it is like a problem that people run into.
I think everybody will run into it at some point. At least once. I did that. We're not a React shop with WordPress, and realizing that a theme that we were using compiled custom CSS, and we needed to set the priority on the hooks because their CSS was loading after ours, so we weren't overriding properly. And it's like, it's a little thing, but those, that order, my CSS was perfect. It was the PHP code that wasn't right in that case. So it's so weird how this can come into play that wasn't foreseen.
I think that understanding, like knowing how to write good CSS selectors and how to structure your CSS, I think is, I'm going to use the term language, and I'll clarify in a moment, similar to like regular expressions or something. It's a language that you're using to communicate with the document about where you want the thing to go. And that's where I think the experience comes in, because if you know, for example, like, well, I want, something I deal with at work. So we have like, you know, the Rails flash hash. It's just like a little like toaster pop up that comes out on the top. If I had like a notice class or something, we might use a notice in a P tag, the content area. But when I'm making that notice styling for the header, I know this is the notice that's going in the header only. And so I would use like the direct descendant operator just to indicate like, well, I only want it to be on the notice divs that show up in here. And then never, you know, that style will never apply anywhere else because it's scoped properly. And I know what you're saying about like the issue of order matters, like how the files are loaded. But I think that's also something just like with experience, you know, you load the lowest dependency things first, and then the most dependent things last, just so that in case there is a specificity override, that it happens the way you want it to.
You know, with the counterpoint that I think goes there is I've been writing CSS a long time. I think my CSS is generally very, very good. Maybe not bomb, but very, very good. And even with my junior devs, when we're doing code review, there comes a point where I fully admit I sometimes scan a little loosely. And I think in a perfect world, the way CSS inheritance works and, you know, the order of things and all that, we would catch all of that and know it. But I think the reality is just a little bit looser. Mm. I think is the only way to put it. We make mistakes. We're people. And we're people trying to fix, computer problems. And we're trying to say, you know what, in this case, let's just let the computer solve the problem. And that's maybe the big value there. Because at the end of the day, we haven't talked about this yet, and maybe we should have, that the idea behind CSS and JS is that every single element that is styled mm-hmm. gets a granular class that is unique to itself. And so the possibility of, you know, any overlap is virtually impossible. Mm-hmm. Not mathematically impossible, but yeah, it's impossible.
Well, it's like hashes, right?
Yeah.
It's just, you'd have to have a hash collision.
Yeah, it takes the content of your style, creates like a unique hash, globally unique to your app. And so it's a guarantee that it won't collide with at least your own styles, which is a pretty nice guarantee.
Yeah, so you always know your CSS will only apply to the thing you wanted it to apply to. That's huge.
Yeah.
It's a unique approach, I think, in that way. And we've talked about this with other CSS patterns, but the way that CSS and JS goes about it is so granular to the point of even including, and this comes down to like which package you're using. If you're using styled components, it factors in all the vendor prefixing for you, everything you need to not think about that we use SAS mix-ins for and things like that. Mm. You know, these components take care of, and it alleviates some of that cognitive need to, did I name it right? Did I put it in the right place? Did I use a direct descendant selector or an any descendant selector? You don't have to think about a lot of that, which is, I think, very cool.
Yeah, for sure. And like if I'm not clear, I want to make it like super clear. Like if you like writing CSS and if you have standards in place for writing CSS and that works for you, like I'm not coming here saying like, let's do this right now. But what I am kind of saying is like, I think it's really like freeing and it's like a nice thing for your team to not have to like start day one with training and like, oh, here's CSS and here's this, you know, 4-hour training or 8-hour training. And then, you know, they still screw stuff up because CSS is challenging in my opinion.
Practice.
You know, so like it's really nice to be like, hey, here's this library, write your style like you did in your CSS files. Don't come up with a class name yourself because you don't have to. And, you know, you get this styled element that won't conflict with anything else. And so to me, that's like reducing the barrier to entry in some sense of like getting up and running and developing quickly. And I'm not going to come here and say there's no learning curve to this. Like there's a learning curve to anything.
Oh, yeah.
But I think it solves some problems with automated tooling that are like really nice for developers of all skill levels.
I think I added learning curve as a disadvantage to this, but I think I need to reassess that. Yeah, I need to reassess it.
It goes on both sides. Yeah,
absolutely. Because for somebody who knows React and is already a React developer, mm-hmm. I don't think there would be any learning curve to this, frankly. And if anything, I do think it would be much easier as an approach.
You'd have to learn it a handful of styles, but yeah.
Yeah, I mean, if you know CSS and if you like kind of understand like the React component model, like you'll understand style components. So it is, you know, effectively real CSS. So like earlier we were mentioning descendant selectors, you know, media queries, like whatever, all of that can go on your style component and it works just like regular CSS.
I did see in your course that you can do the pseudo selectors and the media queries in the with that styled components module, and that's really cool.
And it translates well.
Yeah.
Like, as somebody who writes SAS, seeing how that worked inside of those, what are called template literals in terms of JavaScript development, I understood what was happening there, which I think was good because it means my existing knowledge would translate if I had to jump into that realm. And that's huge. Like being able to see that and know, oh, yeah, I nest that stuff all the time. I can nest it over here. It's a little different, but not hugely different.
I have one small gripe with the hash classes. What would you call them?
Auto-generated hashes.
Yeah. Okay. Auto-generated classes.
Atomic classes. How do we like that?
All right. So I completely understand the benefits, and I do agree that is super useful, and knowing for effectively 99 with triple nines or whatever percent certainty that this class will only apply here, etc. I get that. But I have also tried to like debug an app where I did have a weird CSS thing where I had to add a CSS class to a component that already existed, and like trying to like figure out the disposition of all these different divs and everything else when all of the class names are all hashes is like, oh my god, shoot me.
I don't know if there was like this tweet making the rounds recently of like Twitter's style or Twitter's DOM. The structure. So they use a library, last I checked, called React Native Web. In particular, like this, it's a CSS and JS library, the style sheet implementation part of it. And it similarly generates like this hash name for class names. So agreed, like it can be a little harder to debug. But one kind of cool thing with style components and with this other library I like called Emotion is there are plugins that you can just configure with like, you know, a true or a false that you can kind of turn on like humanized class names in some sense. So for instance, it'll have that hash, and then the next one will be like the name of my component. So if I call this thing like header, it'll be like style dash header.
There's a Babel plugin for that, isn't there? I think.
Yep. And it's actually, there's a macro now, but it's effectively a plugin, that does that for you. So like people really like to slam CSS and JS for that. And like fair, like it is kind of like easy, like hard to like look at this DOM structure and be like, oh god, like what is this? But there are ways around that. You know, you don't have to do it that way.
I think that's also because when you're doing the newer, all the new kids with the React and the JavaScripts and everything else, you have different approaches towards debugging, and you have different tools available, like the ones you just mentioned, and so you aren't going to do the way that we older developers are doing it, which was to like, you know, view source and then, or like use a DOM inspector or something. So, I mean, it's also possible just that, you know, it's an inconvenience for me because I'm not using the tools you are.
Yeah, no, it's there was a pretty interesting tweet. It was like a class war or something. And it's not really, I don't necessarily think it's that, but there is like, I've seen a bunch of tweets that's like, you know, like rest in peace, like view source of the web, like another like, you know, like confident CSS and JS like cause. And like, I do think that people tend to like debug things differently. And yeah, like if you want to like view source, like it can be a little harder with some of these like newfangled JavaScripts and Reacts and, you know, whatever, but I think it's worth it. Like I think that, well, so if we go back to like edge case, like, you know, like your CSS edge case might be like 1%. Your debugging time might be 1%. Like it's kind of an edge case in some sense too. So yeah, use the great tools we have available. I mean, like, you know, a lot of people cut their teeth with like Firebug or whatever, like so much better than anything we used to have. So like use the tools available. It does suck. And I'm not going to come here and say like, semantic HTML and CSS is beautiful. So I lament the loss of that sometimes too, but they're a little behind us, and like I'm okay moving forward with some of this new stuff.
And I'll admit that when I do like an inspect, you know, on an element or something, in my head I think very semantically, and because I have been building these websites for, you know, more years than I care to admit, although I think I have on a past episode, I want semantic things because I think that is the way to articulate stuff to folks who are trying to learn and that nature. But at the same time, I know when I open up an element and I say, this doesn't look the way I need it to, I'm not reading selectors. I'm going through the inspector just seeing where the rule is that is not what I need it to be. And once I know where that is, then I go edit it. And the semantics actually don't come into play there for me as much as what file is it? And what is the selector? And once I know the selector, I'm just going to search for it.
Yeah, it's actually super cool. A lot of people, you know, think it's harder to debug this CSS and JS stuff. A lot of the better libraries, like Style Components, they have source map support. So
that was my exact next question.
Yeah, you can go and like click on and see this auto-generated class. You can click to where it's generated in the JavaScript, and you can see like, oh, this is where this class name was produced. Here's, you know, where I go change it. Like, I know exactly which file. I know which line. Like, it's pretty great stuff. Even if the end result's a little like obfuscated and like hard to read for humans.
Let me switch gears just a hair, because one of the other disadvantages that I've heard in the past and I still wonder about is, you know, the idea behind CSS and JS is that you get this super atomic level CSS that only applies to that element. And even if you're using, you know, if you go broader scope and go to the theme level and things like that, you still end up with a lot of CSS that is rearticulated over and over potentially. And I wonder about both like the bloat that causes in the performance, though how that might compare to me writing CSS where I know probably a tenth to a quarter of my CSS probably is never used. I have no way of knowing. Like, can we talk about just that as far as how you consider CSS and JS as it bloats code, but as it might also even improve that performance because you know that what's there is being used.
Yeah, so I'm glad you mentioned the sense that like it's pretty easy to make your CSS bloated. Not saying everyone writes bloated CSS. You can write beautiful bomb CSS. It is completely possible.
Almost bomb.
Michael, we need to make that a shirt.
Bomb CSS. Noted.
That's our next shirt. Yep.
So with like a library like Style Components, basically the usage of this style is directly tied to the implementation of like where it's used. So I know this component uses like this CSS. And so I can like safely delete this component when I'm no longer using it. And I know like for a fact that this will not be, this style won't be making its way into my, you know, generated CSS. And so what you basically get is like a guarantee again that like all my style is being used. Like critical CSS could not be easier with like a library like Style Components. You don't have to use other tooling. Like might have used some tools to like, you know, parse your like above the fold content and then, you know, get CSS and then like load the rest. If you take a look at like apps like Gmail and, you know, just sometime look at some app, you'll see like the amount of CSS that's unused ranges from like 70% to like even like 90%. And with a library like Style Components or a CSS and JS approach, you know, it's like 95 to like 100% of your style is going to be used, because when you delete the component that's styled, that style's gone from your code. Like it's not used anywhere else.
And it's hard to search for a negative, right? Like if I've got a perfectly written chunk of CSS in my SAS, a bomb piece, this is going to be a recurring joke. I'm sorry. We've got about 20 minutes left. Deal with it. If I've got that perfect chunk of CSS, but that element goes away, it becomes hard to search for the negative and say, what isn't... This is a challenge that has plagued front-end developers for ages, where it's like, how do I know if something is using this class because of the C in CSS? That cascade, depending on how I've written my selectors, becomes very hard to know. Can I delete this safely without impacting anything and have, you know, my CEO come to me tomorrow and complain?
Yeah, it's actually scary. Like you need like pretty solid like visual regression tests or just like a good QA team to like know you're safely deleting unused code. Because like this could be used in ways you don't even like know on some like deeply nested structure in your application. Like I don't want to like rail on GitHub, but they had a screen yesterday where their footer was just in the middle of the page. Someone probably deleted CSS targeting, you know, this element, and they're like, oh, this isn't used anywhere else. And no, it was, you know, it's a hard problem to solve.
I got to give a shout out to my QA person too, because Oscar, I know you're going to hear this, and dude does legitimate hardcore visual, manual QA on everything and catches stuff that we would not even think to catch. And the work he does is phenomenal and can't be stated enough, because it's hard to programmatically test for visual QA. You can do it. It's not easy. And having a human who goes in there and puts eyeballs on stuff is worth their weight in gold. Oscar is a bomb QA tester. I love that. And that is our next shirt. I like it.
That's that shirt number two.
I want to talk about use cases, because the thing that really revolves around all this, and we said it early on in the show, this is a very React-focused kind of thinking. And so it doesn't work for everybody, and it's not appropriate for all use cases. And the thing, when I was sitting there, went through this the course that Dustin put together, great time. I loved what I saw. I enjoyed, you know, the things that he was saying and the way that he approached it. The one thing that came to mind was, this works really well for application development. It works less well for somebody doing normal website development, let's say. Because React itself is very focused on applications, I think. You know, most folks won't go out and build a website with React. They'll throw WordPress up or whatever. So let's, can we talk a little bit about where it is appropriate and not appropriate?
So just to set the table a little bit, what's a website versus like what's an app? Like what?
Yeah, yeah, okay.
What's the meaningful difference?
Fair enough. That is a fair question. Let's say it this way. If I'm using anything that isn't involved in JavaScript, it's probably fair to say that this does not work well in that environment.
I would define the two as it's a continuum, and on one side you have applications, and the other side you have websites. I'm doing air quotes here. And applications are going to be things that have a lot more round trips to and from the server, because the user is providing input beyond simply, this is the page I want you to fetch now. So there's going to be like forms, there's going to be interaction with the web page itself, whereas a website is typically more read-only, maybe with some requests to kind of filter that down. That's how I would define it.
Much more transactional.
It's generally like a complexity thing too. Like a website is going to be simpler, probably just have like a little bit of like JavaScript for like flourishes. It's not going to be like powered by JavaScript in some sense, or powered by server-side rendering, or you know, whatever. So I work for Gatsby, and our whole business model kind of is like, you know, we want to make all of these. We want to make applications. We want people to make websites like with our tool. And so Gatsby generates like this like static HTML with like a runtime. So you can do, you know, what are called websites. So like blogs and, you know, things that can typically be produced like statically and don't need like a ton of like client-side JavaScript. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, it can produce apps as well. As far as how does CSS and JS, like, is it like overkill? So you mentioned that it's kind of like a continuum, like a spectrum of apps versus websites. I think CSS and JS is the same. So for me, I like CSS modules quite a bit, which is kind of, it solves one of the problems that Style Component solves. It kind of solves this.
Is your course? You cover that in your course?
I do, yes. Okay. CSS modules is covered in my course. Okay. So in the same way that you get a unique hash with Style Components, you get a unique hash with CSS modules. And so it solves that, you know, the cascade, the global scope problem. And so, you know, that works really well for like a site, you know. But as far as like whether I would use like React for React Style Components for everything, I would, because Gatsby can produce sites and apps. But if you're not in the like fully JavaScript ecosystem, if you, you know, if you don't want to configure Webpack, if you don't want to like a build tool, like you might not need a library like Style Components.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I'll throw out there real fast that if you're interested in CSS modules, Robin Rendell has a great article over at CSS Tricks. We'll have a link in the show notes that will get you kind of introduced to that concept.
After you've watched Dustin's course.
Yeah, after you go through Dustin's course first, obviously. I want to ask a really obvious question, and it's one that actually, even after going through the course and watching everything that you talked about, it's something that I was a little fuzzy on, and that's, can I use, let's go specifically with the styled components module, if I'm doing Angular development or Vue development, a while back went through the Tour of Heroes tutorial, which is an Angular, like, get you used to Angular development. If I'm using one of those frameworks, can I use CSS and JS, or is it really restricted just to the React realm? Like, where is that useful?
So I do cover this in my course in one section as well. So it depends. Because you know, the whole like, what is CSS and JS? If you ask different people, they might give you different answers. I'm a little more liberal with my definition, and so for me, it's kind of like using automated tooling, using JavaScript to solve some problem to like produce CSS. And so in the Angular realm, they have this notion of like style URLs. It's kind of web component-y in a way. It'll apply like an ID to your element, and then that style URL will like be will target that element like for you. So in some sense, it's kind of like CSS modules. It's a unique hash for your element. Vue has a scoped attribute on its style. And both of these are kind of like CSS modules, some like web component based approaches. They're both trying to solve this scoping issue using like automated build time tooling. And so to me, that is CSS and JS. Opinions may vary on that. That's probably a contentious statement. But to me, it's using tooling, it's using JavaScript to solve a problem for your styling solution. So to me, that is CSS and JS, and like, I think it's a fair definition of it.
Because the alternative, right, is writing your CSS separately, whether that's with, you know, a SAS builder or whatever, Gulp, you know, using Gulp to build that, whatever the case may be, and writing it in the component file and letting styled components build out the... But because I think, right, and correct me if I'm wrong here, but when you are using styled components, it spits all that out in line in the page you're using, right?
So what, yeah, it's probably important to like actually define what styled components does. So styled components, you write your code just like CSS, and what it will produce is style tags in your head tags. So when people get, when they hear CSS and JS, some people think like inline style, and to me, again, that is, you know, CSS and JS, but style components does not produce an inline style, so it doesn't have any of the same drawbacks. So yeah, it produces like a fully real. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
I was just what you were saying. Just makes this proper style tag.
Yep. Yeah. It's you know, quote unquote, like it is real CSS, like is what it produces. So there's no like witchcraft and like whole like rigmarole here. Like it's CSS.
Does there? And this is a very basic question, but the thing that just popped in my head there is, if I am using that and it puts out a page, let's say, because I know when you get into stuff like routes and things like that with single page applications and things, it's all one page anyway, so it doesn't matter. But if it were not that case, can that be put into a, can we output that stream into a CSS file that gets compiled?
Great question. So I am really glad you asked that. Yes, and Gatsby allows you to write CSS and JS. We have support for style components. We have support for like a number of like libraries, and it will parse your styles. It'll parse your style component styles that it will produce, and it'll kind of like short circuit it, and it'll produce like a real CSS file. So there's very little drawback, and so it's an approach called like build time server side rendering. So it'll invoke like React server side renderer. Parse out the styles and then create a real CSS file. So there's very little drawback.
So then you can leverage browser caching at
exactly.
that point.
Yep. Yeah. Yep. And then like when those styles change, like if they're used by you know some percentage of your like routes, because Gatsby doesn't produce a single page app. Gatsby produces a like multi-page app that feels like a single page app. Like it's you know separate HTML files, and it'll produce CSS, critical CSS for each page, which is pretty cool.
So I want to ask one big question because it's relevant to me, and that's all that makes it big. That is the only important thing in this entire question is if it matters to me. Gutenberg. So with WordPress and all the development that's going on with Gutenberg, and I'm asking this partly because I'm in the middle of a course in terms of block development, Gutenberg is built on React. And so I feel like when I start building out my blocks and I've got some ideas in the works that actually are relevant to the podcast and transcripting, if anybody's interested. but with it being built on React, I feel like thinking about styled components, there feels like there is a synergy, not to use that as a fluffy word, but literal, Gutenberg is built on React. I've got styled components. I've got CSS and JS. It feels like there's some opportunity there for me to look at these things in tandem. Is that a fair assessment based on me taking your course and sitting here drinking monkey shoulder and feeling pretty damn good?
So I have not used Gutenberg. So generally, when you, I'll say always, when you use style components, you need a build process. So in the JavaScript space, that's normal. There's like create React app, which people really like. There's Gatsby, which is like, you know, an app compiler, like I said earlier. So I don't know how these components are generated and like how they are written in the context of like WordPress. I would be interested to actually check this out and like do a follow-up and get back to you, because I'm sorry, I don't know offhand. I would imagine there'd be some setup costs of getting it like up and running. But I do think that WordPress using like kind of like adopting React is great. I think React is like kind of like eating the world. Like if you're going to learn any JavaScript library, learn React.
I would agree with that.
But I haven't checked it out personally, so I can't like 100% confirm that would work. Go ahead.
So what I'm hearing is that when I start writing my transcript block, I can just pick up the phone, call you, and you're going to be like, yeah, let's look at this. We're going to do some one-on-one time. Yeah, let's fix it.
Yeah. I will make that offer. I will happily come figure this out. I want to learn about it myself. So it'd be cool to have an informed opinion about what I should think of Gutenberg.
From what I've seen of style components from your course, I would say that Gutenberg blocks are definitely would be a great candidate for the strengths of styled components overall, because those sorts of like, I mean, just knowing the WordPress community and all of the not bomb CSS that I've seen it. I'm sorry, maybe you should edit that out.
Oh no, it's staying in.
Well, anyways, WordPress is the democratization of the code and everything. Great. And I know so many of us got our start in there, but inexperienced developers make maybe things that don't have the knowledge to not collide with other people's things, both PHP and the CSS. But
it's hard. Because it requires a level of prediction that can be very difficult.
And a lot of times you're working in, like, even if you do write good CSS, you're still working in the same namespace as other things. Like, if I have a plugin that affects, I don't know, heading tags, and someone else on that also affects heading tags, and they're both in the post namespace, you know, you're going to have more potential for collisions. And so I will modify my earlier comments specifically for WordPress, because I think WordPress is definitely an edge case, but it's an edge case that would fit itself well to a solution like this.
And I'll make the covenant with our listeners that between now and when this episode releases, I'm going to reach out on Twitter. I'm going to see if anybody is doing this right now, because I don't know of anybody that is off the top of my head. But if anybody is using, whether it's CSS modules or CSS and JS styled components, JSS, Emotion, any of these things, I would be curious to know if anybody has taken that leap. Because I think that there's a lot of value there. And that's, WordPress owns a third of the web. So what they do matters in that context. And I think that's why this particular topic is very important, because this, it may be the way that you know you write your WordPress plugins so that they never have to conflict with another one in term of styling. And that's incredibly important, I think, and valuable at the end of the day. So let's talk about resources, though, because obviously we've mentioned many times, Dustin has a course. We're going to talk about that after the break. Don't worry about that. A, very good, very well written. It is the exact right amount. I think correct me on this, Dustin, 2.75 hours?
Yeah, I'd say 2 to 3 hours. You know, some people like a little, but yeah, right around there.
Like the least amount of time you can learn, commit to learning something and still learn all the things.
It has transcripts. The transcripts are tag coded, and you can click on the transcript and it will jump to that part. I was like, when I saw that you could do that, I was like, oh my gosh, this is amazing.
And you can speed up the playback.
Yes.
I've gotten really used to being able to go into courses and hit like the one I was doing one on Gutenberg recently, and I could go up to 1.75, and I was like, I can take a little faster, but the application couldn't. So I was like, I was stuck at 1.75, but it is a great way to go in and learn this stuff, you know, and get a feel for it. And I do think that from a front end development standpoint, it's whether or not you want to get good at it is not the point. It's knowing that it exists and understanding how it plays into the ecosystem, because you will potentially have to touch something that uses it at some point. So CSS in JS Playground, right, is you made this, right, Dustin?
I did make this, yeah.
Made it your thing.
Yeah.
So there will be a link. It's cssnjsplayground.com. And so what this does is, we mentioned before, and we may not have done a great job of conveying this, but this idea of CSS and JS is an idea. It's a concept. And there are many ways to execute it. And so
it's a state of mind.
Yeah. And a lot of these folks have created other libraries that apply this. And so what the Playground does is lets you see how all of these different libraries that you could choose from, whether that's styled components, whether that's JSS, whether that's Emotion, any of these different frameworks, they have slightly different, because it's like any framework, slightly different lexicon, slightly different taxonomy, but you can see how they apply. Do I have that right? I hope I have that right.
Could have said it any better. So I wrote this. I gave a talk on CSS and JS, and it was the whole idea is like, well, like, what is this? Like, what can you all do with it? And so I wanted a way that you could check out like a variety of different solutions. So on the left is like the code. On the right is like a live editing demo of what the code with the style is building. And
like
so
code pin, if you've seen a code pin or something like that.
And so, yeah, you just build the same form and a bunch of different libraries, and you know, you look at the code that built it. So hopefully it's a helpful resource for people who want to like check out this space and learn a little more about it.
Can the user edit that? Is that something like they can go in and play with and see the results immediately too?
Yeah, you can go in, like change the styles, you can change the colors, you can, it's very code pen light. It's not as good as code pen because you know, just one of me, but it works for that use case.
Awesome.
Cool.
So give us a second. We're going to go take off, relieve ourselves, do the things. You don't need to know about that. That's too much information. I understand. But I'm Michael, and you know how I am. Give us a minute. We'll be right back. We'll wrap up and stick with us. The Drunken UX Podcast is brought to you by our friends at NewCloud. NewCloud is an industry-leading interactive map provider who has been building location-based solutions for organizations for a decade. Are you trying to find a simple solution to provide your users with an interactive map of your school, city, or business? Well, NewCloud's interactive map platform gives you the power to make and edit a custom interactive map in just minutes. They have a team of professional cartographers who specialize in map illustrations of many different styles and are ready to design an artistic rendering to fit your exact needs. One map serves all of your users' devices with responsive maps that are designed to scale and blend in seamlessly with your existing website. To request a demonstration or to view their portfolio, visit them online at newcloud.com/drunkenux. That's nucloud.com/drunkenux. Well, I want to take a second. I want to thank Dustin, man. Awesome. I appreciate you jumping on with us tonight. I know you are both busy and smart and important, and you do all the things that I do not have the time to do. And for that, I have more respect than I know what to put in a box and send to you. So the only thing I have to do at this point is to give you the microphone. Tell folks where they can find you, what you've got going on, what projects that you want people to look at. Take whatever you need. You do that.
All right. Hopefully I can do it in like 30 seconds or so. Follow me on Twitter. Twitter, Shao Dustin. S-C-H-A-U. It's not a super easy name to spell.
We'll link it. Don't worry.
I tweet about CSS and JS. I tweet about Gatsby. which are hopefully things you're interested in, general front end stuff. So if you want to learn more, you know, feel free to reach out. I think I'm a friendly guy. Happy to answer any questions, discuss anything, message me, you know, whatever you want. As far as my course, it's really good to hear people are liking it. That is awesome. It's good that I don't have to say. I think it's good. I can, someone can say it for me. So I appreciate the kind words. Check out the course if you find any of this interesting. If you're running into any of the problems that I've identified, check it out. Or if not, if you think you might run into them, check it out. I hope you like it. In the course, you build out like a blogging application and you learn some of the concepts, I think, in like a gentle, gradual introduction. So
I would agree with that.
Hopefully it's not like super intimidating or anything, because the goal is kind of like start from the zero, like, and then, you know, hopefully get to where you can like actually use these tools. Check out Gatsby. I work for a company called Gatsby. It's interesting because it's an open source product. So we're building out, we will make money hopefully soon. right now it's a really cool tool in the React space that I think is pretty revolutionary. So check it out, gatsbyjs.org. And thanks for listening, everyone. I really appreciate the opportunity to come talk something I'm passionate about.
I want to ask a really stupid question, if I can. Because that's what I do really well. And what does the name come from, Gatsby? Where did you pick that from? What is it, literally the book, The Great Gatsby?
That's a good question. So everyone thinks like The Great Gatsby. And so the CEO, Kyle Matthews, has been asked that question like repeatedly, and he just liked the term. So no affiliation with The Great Gatsby. Just a cool word.
This is like the normal Gatsby.
Good. Yeah. The one that isn't killing people with car and throwing massive parties and waking up the neighbors. This one is the one that does 9 to 5, pays their taxes, and like helps their community.
I feel like I'm like outing myself too, because I have not read The Great Gatsby. I should read The Great Gatsby at some point.
I feel like I was supposed to back in high school, but that was the exact perfect time that a website called Spark Notes came into being, where you could go and get for free, like, the, it was Cliff Notes, but better and free. I don't know what it is today, because I'm 37. I don't need to pass high school courses. Anyway, folks, thanks for listening this week.
Wait. We have...
What?
We have a coupon code.
I don't know what you're talking about. Please tell me.
We're supposed to give this to everyone, right? This
Please.
One?
Yeah. I need you to tell me, Aaron. Please tell me.
POD DRUNKUX19 is a coupon discount code for any of you listeners can use, and it will give you a discount on this course and maybe on other courses? Or is it just this course?
Okay, so here's the deal, right? If you go to, is it manning.com?
M-A-N-N-I-N-G.
It is, they are a technology publisher of sorts. I had not heard of them before this. Aaron, you had an account with them.
I didn't remember hearing of them, but apparently I did, because I have an account already. So,
so somewhere Surprise. Along the lines, they had crossed Aaron's radar. So if you go to their website, it's manning.com, and enter poddrunkux19. I know, it's long. I didn't choose it. It's not my fault. Don't blame me. It will get you a discount. I realize now that I don't know how much of a discount. I don't know if it's 10%, 20%. I just know that's the discount code.
Yeah. And you all get it.
I pulled it up. I was using all of this rambling as a chance to pull it up and confirm that, and I realized it doesn't even say. So, but at any rate, go check them out. Manning.com. Look up the CSS in JavaScript by Dustin Chow. PodDrunkUX19 will get you a discount. But
we'll
better
put a link
than
out
that,
too.
Well, obviously we'll send a link, because that's just the way that works. Better than that. If you are a listener of the Drunken UX podcast and you follow us on Twitter or Facebook or any of those things, here's what you do. Go to those places wherever you're following us and just share or retweet.
Yes.
If you follow us and you share, you'll be entered to win one of three passes for the CSS in JavaScript course.
You have to specifically retweet or share the original post.
Yeah, and it'll say. It'll have something in there about that. But at any rate, We are going to give away three passes to his course. You can go in if you're a React developer, if you're somebody who's interested in React development.
Like, full pass, not discount. Yeah. You get it for free.
And I think, right, it's, we said earlier, it's 2 to 3 hours somewhere in there. Yeah. It doesn't take a lot of time. It's incredibly helpful and useful. And so we've got that to give to you, and I think that is amazing. Yes. So thank check you so that much. Out. And otherwise, all I have to say is check us out if you want to get in on that, Twitter or Facebook, .com/DrunkenUX. Instagram is /DrunkenUXPodcast. Share any of those when we put them up when the show goes live, and you'll be entered to win. Otherwise, DrunkenUX.com/Slack gets you into our chat channel. And, hell, I don't know. I got one thing to say. Folks,
put your tray tables in the upright and locked position.
That, wow, you really held on to that joke till the end, didn't you? Wait. Oh. Hold on. I have to give you one thing, though. Yeah. The only thing I can give you is this.
Yes!
I will give you your click. That was a good joke. I'm not going to cut that out. That's the joke you've been waiting for. So, everybody else, thanks for listening. And the only thing I can leave you with is to keep your personas close and your users closer. Bye-bye.